It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
The way it's going to work is now when a bank gets a garnishment order, they have 2 days to take a look at the account, and they would look back 2 months. This is called the look-back period. And in that 2 months, if I have gotten a Social Security check, or typically two checks, then they would add up those checks. Let's say I got $500 each month. Two times 500 is $1,000. That amount of money would be the protected amount. And that means that the bank is prohibited from freezing $1,000 in my account.
Jay Spear, Executive Director of the Virginia Poverty Law Center, describes how creditors no longer will be able to freeze and take funds from bank accounts that contain Social Security, SSI, VA, and other federal benefits, and the rules about when an employer can and cannot take part of a worker's pay to compensate for losses is discussed during this week's question and answer session. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 123, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's news you can use. Last Thursday, April 14, 1,500 Richmonders involved to strengthen our communities, or RISC, gathered at the 2011 Nehemiah Action. 6 out of 9 Richmond City Council members were present, although all 9 had promised to appear. The 6 members each were asked 3 questions. First, will you support the Affordable Housing Trust Fund Oversight Board, being fully appointed and convening no later than June 2011? All 6 said yes. Second, will you support changing the Affordable Housing Trust Fund ordinance to guarantee that at least half of the funding goes toward projects directly benefiting households earning 30% or less of the area median income? Again, all 6 said yes. Third, will you support the Affordable Housing Trust Fund Oversight Board recommending a source of dedicated funding of at least $3 million in annual revenue? And 5 out of 6 said yes. Although a clear majority of City Council supports all 3 of the recommendations, RISC is taking no chances and asking supporters of the Affordable Housing Trust Fund to attend the upcoming Richmond City Council meeting at City Hall on Monday, April 25 at 5:30 p.m. In other news, last week's congressional approval of an overall spending package that cut $38 billion for the fiscal year that ends September 2011 included cuts in Legal Services Corporation basic field funding of almost $16 million, or about a 3.75% decrease. However, because legal aid programs already have received 5 out of 12 monthly checks for the current fiscal year at pre-funding cut levels, the cut in the remaining 7 checks will be about 6.5%. In real dollar terms, this means that between now and the end of September, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society will receive $50,000 less in federal funding than it would have without the cuts. Because legal aid programs are nonprofit agencies that provide free services and are not allowed to charge our clients, $50,000 less over the next 7 months means one of 2 things. other funders must make up the difference, which is possible, or staff and services must be reduced, which is more likely. Despite this difficulty, legal aid came out better than most human services and had a significantly smaller cut than other agencies within the Justice Department and the LSC Appropriations Subcommittee. Of the $38 billion of spending cuts, more than half hit programs in education, labor, and health. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegebright. You are listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's case that changed the Commonwealth is Yore versus Jefferson National Bank. On July 17, 1987, Chesapeake Bay Builders Incorporated borrowed $100,000 from a local bank. On the same date, Charles Yore Jr., a principal in Bay Builders, and his spouse, Louise Yore, co-signed on the loan. Louise Yore had no interest in Bay Builders. She was not a joint applicant for credit, and the bank made no inquiry about her credit standing. Bay Builders defaulted on the loan. When the bank sued, Mrs. Yore defended that she was required to sign the guarantee solely on the basis of her marital status as the wife of Charles Yore Jr., which violated the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, and therefore her co-signing was void. The circuit court struck her defense, but the Supreme Court of Virginia reversed. The court held that to deny Mrs. Yore the right to use the violation as a defense would be to enforce conduct that is forbidden by the Equal Credit Opportunity Act. This has been the law ever since. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault, and Yore versus Jefferson National Bank is this week's Case That Changed the Commonwealth.
You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. It's time for this week's question and answer. We're here in the studio with this week's questioner. Please tell us your name and where you're from.
Hi, my name is Caroline, and I was born and raised in Richmond.
Welcome to the show, Caroline. What question do we have this week?
Well, several years ago, I was working at a hotel that actually had two restaurants and a bar, etc. And because it was an interior environment, frequently we would have guests walk away without paying their checks. There were actually so many of those happening that the restaurant hotel decided to send us out a written notice, which we were expected to sign, saying that if we had guests walk out on us, that we would be responsible for paying their tab. They wanted us to sign a statement saying individuals were allowing the hotel restaurant to deduct money out of your check, and that it would be done any time you actually had somebody walk up and leave.
Well, Caroline, that raises a whole lot of interesting issues, particularly under the Fair Labor Standards Act. Generally, the employer is not allowed to take anything out of your pay without your written permission. Now, in this case, it sounds like the employer was making a bare attempt to comply with that by having you sign this general authorization to deduct from your pay amounts that basically the customers stiffed you. I don't think that's going to necessarily comply because that's not a specific amount. You don't know in advance what those checks are going to be. And so I don't think you can authorize essentially a blank check withdrawal from your pay. Moreover, assuming for the sake of discussion that you could, the Fair Labor Standards Act still requires that you be paid the minimum wage, which these days is $7.25 an hour. And even if you are a tipped employee, your wages plus your tips have to be at least $7.25 an hour. If you're a tipped employee, they can pay you $2.13 an hour plus tips. But if your tips don't make it up to $7.25 an hour, they have to pay you $7.25 an hour. And I would argue that even if you have authorized a withdrawal for the being stiffed on the check, and that is considered legitimate, even though it's kind of a blank authorization, that you still are entitled to $7.25 an hour. Thank you so much for being on the show. You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. We're here at the Virginia Poverty Law Center, and we're speaking with Jay Spear, the executive director and also the consumer law expert, and we will be speaking about the new federal rule about bank account garnishments. Welcome to the show, Jay.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
It's good to have you back. Now, to put this in context for our listeners, can you first tell us, how does a bank account garnishment work?
If someone is sued for a debt that they haven't paid and gets a judgment against them, then the creditor can then garnish somebody's bank account or sometimes wages. But when they garnish a bank account, the bank that where you have an account gets an order from the court saying that that you owe a creditor a certain amount of money. And that if that bank holds money belonging to you, then they are supposed to turn it over to the creditor.
Are there certain funds that are exempt from garnishment, whether it's directly at the source or otherwise?
That's right. And that's been part of federal law for many, many years, probably 50 years. Your Social Security benefits or SSI or Railroad Retirement or VA benefits, all these things are exempt under federal law, and there are also benefits that are exempt under state law, which means that a creditor cannot get to those benefits.
What would those benefits that are exempt under state law be?
Well, that would be unemployment or workers' compensation, things like that.
So what has the problem been? If these benefits are exempt from garnishment, then what has been the issue?
This is the way this happens. When I started at Central Virginia Legal Aid back in 1987, one of the first cases I ever got was a lady came in because she got – her only income was Social Security benefits, and it was not very much income. But she came in because her bank account had been frozen, and what I later found out is that what banks do when you get a garnishment on your account, they freeze the account automatically. And they make no effort to determine whether the funds are exempt or not. And even though the only funds in your account may be Social Security, they still freeze that account. What then has to happen is that the debtor or the account holder has to go to court and get that garnishment lifted. And that's why that lady was coming in to see me at Legal Aid to get my help to get that garnishment lifted. For many years, we have tried to get the banks to do something about this because particularly nowadays when I get my Social Security or benefits like that directly deposited into an account, it's really obvious that where that money is coming from. And in fact, if you look at somebody's bank statement who's having their federal benefits directly deposited, it's very clear where that money is coming from. And it's also very clear that that money should be exempt from garnishment. And we asked the banks for years and years to say, we told them, we said, look, all you got to do is a few mouse clicks on a computer, figure out that this money is exempt and not turn it over to the creditor. But the banks have steadfastly refused to do this.
And why have they steadfastly refused to do this? I mean, you've explained that these monies, federal benefits, Social Security, SSI, and some state benefits as well, are exempt from creditors. And it seems that the banks, by holding them for eventual turnover to the creditors, are violating either federal or state law. Why are they doing that?
All I can tell you is the reasons they give us for why they do that. And they've given basically two reasons over the years. One is they claim that if they don't turn over the money to the creditor, then they could somehow be held liable to the creditor. But this is absolute nonsense because, as you just said, it is exempt money and they have no duty to turn that over to a creditor. The second reason that they have given us for years is that it is too much of an administrative burden on them to determine that the money is exempt. Again, I think this is total nonsense because, as I said before, I see this as nothing more than a few mouse clicks to figure out that the money is exempt. And I will note that the new rule that we're going to talk about in a minute, the banks made the exact same arguments to the federal bank regulators, particularly the Treasury Department, and the Treasury Department basically said, that's nonsense.
So let's talk about this new rule. It, I gather, covers federally deposited benefits in a bank account. How is this going to work?
The way it's going to work is now when a bank gets a garnishment order, they have 2 days to take a look at the account, and they would look back 2 months. This is called the look-back period. And in that 2 months, if I have gotten a Social Security check, or typically two checks, then they would add up those checks. Let's say I got $500 each month. Two times 500 is $1,000. That amount of money would be the protected amount. And that means that the bank is prohibited from freezing $1,000 in my account. If I have $1,000 or less in my account when the bank gets the garnishment order, they cannot freeze any money. If I have more than $1,000, they can freeze the amount over $1,000, but the amount $1,000 or less is going to be protected. And when I say it's a protected amount, that means they cannot freeze it, and they must allow me access to those funds, despite the garnishment.
What federal benefits does this apply to? In other words, when the bank looks back 60 days from the day they received the garnishment order, what types of federal benefits are they looking to see if were possibly deposited in the account?
This is only going to apply to certain benefits. It's only going to apply to Social Security, retirement, Social Security disability, SSI, VA benefits, railroad retirement benefits, federal railroad unemployment and sickness, federal civil service retirement system, and federal employee retirement system benefits. So it doesn't include everything. For example, it does not protect military retirement payments or military benefits. And it also doesn't protect state benefits. And so I think there's more work to be done to expand this rule to cover those additional benefits.
Now, is this rule going to apply to every single creditor who garnishes a bank account, or are there some creditors that the rule is not going to apply to?
Two categories of creditors it's not going to apply to. One is going to be the federal government collecting its own debts. And typically what you have there would be for taxes. Or unfortunately, another big category is going to be federally guaranteed student loans. That's one category, government collecting its debts. And the second one is going to be for child support. And the reason for this is that your federal benefits like Social Security are not exempt from those creditors anyway. So that's why the rule doesn't apply for those creditors.
So what if a bank account has what we describe as commingled funds? That is, some of the money in the account is federally protected benefits and others is not federally protected benefits. The rule still applies in that situation?
Yes, absolutely. And this has also been a huge problem for us over the years, particularly those of us that work at Legal Aid that have been trying to help folks. The so-called commingling problem has been a big problem. And in fact, some courts have even said that if you have, up until now, that have said if you have $1,000 of Social Security in your account and just a couple of dollars from somebody maybe you'd gotten on your birthday or something, that you could lose your total exemption. This new Treasury rule will specifically do away with that, and it does not matter whether you exempt benefits are mixed with non-exempt benefits. You get the rule is really very clear. You look back two periods, you add up the exempt benefits, and you make that a protected amount regardless of where those funds came from.
And does the debtor, the account holder, have to do anything, or is the bank supposed to do this automatically with no action by the debtor, the account holder?
It is the latter. The debtor has to do nothing. The banks must do this automatically. The only time a debtor is going to have to do something is if you have money in your account that exceeds the protected amount. So let's say if you get $500 a month in Social Security, and so they look back and they protect $1,000in let's say in your account, but let's say at the time you get the garnishment order, you have $1,500 in there. That $500 is going to be frozen. Now, it could be that that money is exempt money. It could be that you are just very frugal and have not spent all your Social Security money and maybe have saved up some of it. You can still go to court and protect that additional $500 amount, but you are going to have to file a petition with the court and show some sort of proof that it's exempt benefits, and that's pretty much the way the system works now. So you will be required to take that extra step, but for the protected amount, no, you don't have to do anything.
And can the bank charge any type of a fee for protecting the amount? Because that is a big issue that happens now. When the bank gets a garnishment order, they slap on a garnishment fee, sometimes $100.
That is a very, very big problem. And what the new rule says is that the bank cannot take a fee out of this protected amount. However, there is somewhat of a loophole there, and that is if you have money over the, as I described earlier, if you have money over the protected amount, they could potentially take their fee out of that unprotected amount. But for a lot of people, and particularly the folks that we represent, there are not a lot of people that are going to have more than the protected amount. This is going to help most people, and in most cases, the banks are not going to be able to take that fee, which we've always felt over the years is totally illegal anyway because they're taking their fee out of exempt funds.
So this new rule takes effect on May the 1st. Now, do we expect the banks to fully comply with this new rule? And if they don't comply, is there any remedy provided?
We do expect the banks to comply, and we certainly hope the banks will comply. I have to admit that I'm somewhat skeptical given their past efforts to get around this and to refuse to cooperate on it. But you would certainly think they would comply since this is coming from the bank regulators and the Treasury Department. If they don't comply, there is nothing in this new rule that gives you a right to sue them. However, if you go to legal aid or another good attorney, hopefully they can think of another way that you could come back against the bank for not doing this. But again, I really expect the banks to comply. And if we find that they're not, I think we should really raise Cain about it.
Well, very good. We have been speaking, who is the executive director of the Virginia Poverty Law Center. We have been talking about the new federal rule that will protect bank accounts from being garnished if they have directly deposited federal benefits in them. Thank you so much for being on the show, Jay.
You're welcome.
This week's Strange But True Law is from Title 10.1, which deals with conservation. Under Code of Virginia 10.1-1004, it shall be unlawful for any person without express prior written permission of the owner to break off, crack, carve upon, write, burn, or otherwise mark upon, remove, or in any manner destroy, disturb, deface, mar, or harm the surfaces of any cave or any natural material which may be found therein. However, the law does not apply to an owner of a cave on his own property. So, if you want to vandalize a cave, the answer is simple. Buy the cave. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King, and that's this week's Strange But True Law.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid radio show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid radio show ever broadcast is now available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. Even if you or your medical bills have been paid by your employer due to a workplace injury, you must file a claim with the Workers' Compensation Commission to protect your right to benefits. Tune in next Wednesday at 12:30 p.m. when Virginia Workers' Compensation Commissioner Virginia Diamond explains the one thing you must know if you have been injured on the job in a rebroadcast of a show originally heard on December 2, 2009. That's law for the rest of us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright.